Another story Wells liked to tell was about his childhood and the claim that the first word his mother ever spoke to him was genius. And true or not, Orson Welles was indeed born a genius, or, literally and successfully, raised to be one. Taking on a mythic quality, the genius within Orson was supported by the contention of his future guardian, Dr. Maurice Bernstein, that an 18-month-old Orson told him that the desire to take medicine is one of the greatest features that distinguishes men from the animals. As a child of such brilliance, he was profiled in the Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times under the headline, Cartoonist, Actor, Poet, and Only 10. Describing him as a voracious reader of books about the old masters, with a facility for language comparable to that of an adult, the article also illustrates Orson's almost manic desire for creative expression. At times when Orson is in the midst of a story and becomes particularly interested in one of the characters, he is seized with the inspiration to paint the character, and forthwith takes up his box of oil paints, making a study that, though amateurish in technique, shows a keen insight and interpretation. The simple, absolute fact of young Orson's genius, first encouraged by his mother Beatrice and then by everyone else, was so thoroughly ingrained that Wells later joked that it had never occurred to me that I wasn't a genius until middle age. Being declared a genius from birth leads life in many directions. A normal childhood, however, is rarely one of them. And such was the case with George Orson Welles, who took his first breath on May 6, 1915, in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Orson was the second child for Richard and Beatrice Welles. Another son, Richard, Dickie, was 10 years older and had already failed to live up to his parents' expectations. Later diagnosed with schizophrenia, Dickie was unable to exude charm or brilliance, thus causing his parents to imbue Orson with all of their hopes and dreams.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this week we are talking about The Other Side of the Wind. Now, I'm sure most, if not all of you, are saying, what's The Other Side of the Wind? I've never seen that movie. And no, you haven't seen it because it's an unfinished movie. In fact, it is Orson Welles' last film, which has spent more than 40 years languishing in vaults around the world in some form or another. And joining me to talk about it is the author of the book, Orson Welles' Last Movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind, Josh Karp. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you, Rob?
I'm doing great. I'm so thrilled to have you here. As I told you on Twitter and in email, I was a huge fan of your book. I didn't even know, you know, that there was a book about The Other Side of the Wind. It was just one of these things that I've always heard about, you know, the little details of Other Side of the Wind. And I was like, wow, there's a whole book about it? It's fantastic. So I got it as soon as I could, and I finished it in like a week or something. It was very, very cool. I absolutely loved it. So I'm thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
Before we get into The Other Side of the Wind specifically, which is, again, mostly what we're here to talk about, I do want to ask you, like, what is your history as a fan of Orson Welles' filmography? And the reason I sort of ask that is because for a lot of people, if you're into Orson Welles, you kind of have to make an effort, because a lot of his films are not readily available the way other bigger directors have been, other than, of course, Citizen Kane. So what's your history with the man's work?
You know, I think, kind of looked at this hopefully as something of an advantage. I mean, I liked Orson Welles' movies, and I genuinely have always considered Citizen Kane to be, you know, just as pure movie making, like the greatest movie I've ever seen. But I was not like a Welles person. I'm not a Welles scholar. I hadn't seen every Welles movie before I got interested in this. I knew his story, but I was not a Wellesian, as it were. I was just somebody who, like you were saying, you know, you were excited that there was a book about this. I was really excited there wasn't a book about it.
Right.
I mean,
sure.
That was, to me, you know, I came upon what I considered to be this incredible story, and I found him fascinating as an artist and as a person and as somebody whose art and his life really kind of converged. So just, you know, simply put, I mean, I was not any bigger of a fan of, you know, Welles than I am of, you know, Francis Ford Coppola or Martin Scorsese. I just happened upon a great story about Orson Welles.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, for people, again, who listening to this who aren't terribly familiar with Welles' career outside of Citizen Kane, I mean, his trouble basically started with his second film. That was really – things immediately started to kind of go off the rails. Because Citizen Kane famously is that he was given carte blanche by RKO to make the movie exactly as he wanted to make it. He got Final Cut, which for someone of his position where he was coming in as a new filmmaker was pretty much unheard of. I think like Charlie Chaplin and D.W. Griffith were like the only guys at the time that were afforded that level of creative freedom. And so – you know, Welles made the movie he wanted to make, which was Citizen Kane. And you mentioned, I think it's the greatest film of all time. I'm pretty much on there, on that same page with you. I saw it when I was in high school, hearing a lot about it, and I watched it, and I went, oh, this is everything. It's the rare movie that it's everything it's cracked up to be. His next film was The Magnificent Ambersons, which he did not appear in. He narrates it. And unfortunately, that film... during the editing got mangled because he had left the country on a trip asked of him by FDR to make a sort of pro-allies sort of short film, which morphed into some other project. And while he was out of the country working on that film, which would later be known as It's All True, Magnificent Ambersons got apparently a terrible press screening or a test screening, and it was edited without Welles' instructions. And apparently, like 30 minutes of the movie was lopped off and burned. Like that footage has never been found. And that started the history with Welles that he was a guy that couldn't finish his movies. And this sort of dogged him his whole career. I mean, other than Touch of Evil and The Stranger and some things here and there, he pretty much never was able to shake that idea that he was somebody that was a creative genius, but never could quite put it all together. And that's something that dogged on the other side of the wind. Now, why don't you talk a little bit about like what the other side of the wind even really is?
Well, so, you know, after, he made Touch of Evil came out in 1958, I think. That had been, you know, his kind of like, oh, I'm going to go back to Hollywood. I'm going to give it a shot making a studio movie. And he made it for Universal. And every Welles film after Citizen Kane has pretty much a story about why it isn't the film it was supposed to be.
Yep.
And there are, you know, one of the reasons for that, you know, is oftentimes his financial situation. But in terms of, you know, other side of the wind, what happened was, so in 58, he comes back, you know, or he's here, he makes Touch of Evil. He winds up, you know, clashing with Universal over, in a similar fashion to Magnificent Ambersons, except he was there, over what the final version would be in the final edit. I think there was a bad screening, or half the people thought it was brilliant, half the people disliked it. So Universal started cutting the film on their own and trying to make it what they wanted it to be. So Welles wrote this, you know, famous 58-page memo. It fell on, you know, explaining all the ways that they could make it better. It fell on deaf ears, and Welles kind of just leaves after that. Says, you know, I can't work in this industry anymore. You know, I'm going to go to Europe and make movies where I'm appreciated. So he then spends, you know, the next 12 years making movies in Europe, you know, all of them having some epic story of, you know, the business partner who declared bankruptcy,
right.
You know,
right.
Midway through, you know, or several business partners who declared bankruptcy during the course of the movie, you know, people who stole funds from the movie, you know, making movies for 3 months in one place, stopping, you know, doing something else for a year, then coming back and shooting it, you know, in another place, you know, very... you know, everything, and he made some good films. He made The Trial. He made Chimes at Midnight.
Midnight.
A lot of people, a lot of Welles people regard that as his greatest film. But he really didn't have, you know, he didn't have what he wanted, I think. And what happened was, 1970, he comes back to make some money. He had a gig on doing the Dean Martin during the Dean Martin show, which was wild. He would come out and recite Shakespeare, you know, in the middle of, things where, Dean Martin, would then be in a golf cart with, Flip Wilson in the next
Right,
scene,
right.
You know?
The gold diggers come out and dance, yeah.
Right, just completely weird. And he and Dean Martin, really liked each other and were kind of buddies. So he got, and he did really well, financially off of these things. That funded his ability to make movies. So he came back, and he had this script that he'd started in the late 50s that kind of started out being about a Hemingway-like character who was an aging novelist who had kind of lost his creative powers, was a famous womanizer, who is spending his life kind of being trailed around by sycophantic, literary scholars, students, and everybody's telling him he's great. And he's, inside he's a disaster and he's lost everything. And he basically falls in some form of love with a matador. And I think, the kind of thing is this outs the man's man Hemingway type character as being homosexual. And he becomes obsessed with his matador, follows him around. So as the years progress, and he had a run-in with Hemingway in 1937. They wound up becoming friends, but they had this kind of fight. And, he had, called Wells, a gay slur of some kind during the fight. So it was a little bit of this weird vengeance at Hemingway. But so then what happened was, over the years, the story evolved into the story of a film director named Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood after spending several years in Europe, ready to, trying to get money to finish his innovative comeback movie, which is exactly what Wells does in 1970.
Right.
So that's kind of a little long preamble, but so the movie is the story of a director who's making a movie, who's trying to raise funds to finish this movie, and he's a great director who had a great career, but has kind of fallen out of favor, though he is beloved by film students and scholars, and everybody's writing his biography and things like that. And he returns, and he is obsessed with his leading man in this picture, and he's always been this very manly, kind of swashbuckling figure. And, of course, he is revealed to be obsessed with this, young man. And that underneath all of everything, he's destroyed and he's secretly gay. So Wells comes back in 1970 to make a film that's, about exactly what he was doing in 1970, except he wasn't, ostensibly gay. So that is what The Other Side of the Wind is about.
Now, so, yeah, I mean, and we should talk about the cast a little bit. I mean, playing Jake Hannaford is John Huston, another director, legendary director, a longtime friend of Wells, is Peter Bogdanovich, and yet another director who was, in 1970, about as hot as anybody could be, is in the movie. Susan Strasberg, Oya Kodar, which was Wells' wife, or I don't know, was it his wife or
his
partner?
His mistress.
Okay.
Mistress.
Yeah. All right. Joseph McBride, Lily Palmer's in it, Edmund O'Brien, Mercedes McCambridge, Cameron Mitchell, Paul Stewart, who was in Citizen Kane, Peter Jason, who people have seen in a lot of John Carpenter movies.
Everything, yeah.
Right. Norman Foster, Dennis Hopper, Gregory Sierra, who people know from Barney Miller. I mean, it's just like this.
Right.
Claude Chabrol, Paul Mazursky, Henry Jaglom. I mean, Rich Little played a character that was later deleted and had to be replaced by the aforementioned Peter Bogdanovich. I mean, this thing just became kind of this rolling party that Wells would just shoot pieces of here and there. I mean, and you get into the book, you get that deep into the book about just how thrown together this thing sort of had to be.
Yeah, I think, Wells, he had this idea that that the movie was going to be two movies. It was going to be a film within the film, which is this kind of making fun of people like Antonioni. It's this symbolic, beautiful, arty kind of piece of meaningless nonsense. So that's the film that Hannaford is making. And then there's more of a kind of documentary-style film about Hannaford and a birthday party that's being thrown for Hannaford by a kind of Marlena Dietrich-ish actress who's trying to help him get back into Hollywood and raise the money. And so they started filming in 1970 in the summer in a rented home off of in Beverly Hills. And and they did not really finish shooting, I think, until like I think the last shots were taken in 76. And what he would do was, you know, he would film for 3 or 4 months and he'd run out of money. And then he'd go, you know, to Europe and act in a couple of films, or he'd, you know, film a TV series for the BBC or something like that. And then he'd gather money, and then he'd come back and he'd shoot, you know, for 3 or 4 more months, and then he'd go off and get money. And, you know, his life was very chaotic that way, especially financially. And, I think that the thing that always strikes me as most telling about the film is, you know, so well, you know, the film, you know, he denied it being autobiographical, but obviously he's doing what he says, you know, his career is following the trajectory of the main character's career. But the thing that I always love is, so Bogdanovich had just made Last Picture Show in 1970, or was making Last Picture Show. Before that, he was Welles' biographer. He was writing a book with Welles. And it was kind of, like a book of interviews. So the first day of shooting, Welles has Bogdanovich playing a journalist who is writing, you know, about Hannaford, right, who's writing a book about him, just as Bogdanovich was doing at the time. And Joe McBride, who's another Welles biographer, is playing another guy who's writing a book about Hannaford. Okay, and Houston's not there yet, by the way. Houston, he did not cast the lead until 3 years into shooting. So he's standing in off camera as the main character, and he's got two of his biographers playing two of this guy's biographers. Now, 3+ years later, John Huston is there. They're in Arizona shooting, and this is where the bulk of, you know, much of the film was shot. And because, of course, he had the lead there, so he needed to shoot a lot of the film at that point. And what happened was Rich Little was supposed to play this guy who is a hot young director who is a former protege of the of Jake Hannaford's, who has had 3 hit films in a row, which is exactly who Peter Bogdanovich was in this moment. And Rich Little, for reasons, you know, various stories about, you know, why he wound up not remaining on the film, but he either had to leave or was fired. And Welles needed somebody to fill this role. And he was talking to Bogdanovich on the phone. They talked like every day. And he's talking about, oh my God, I've lost Rich Little. What are we going to do? And Bogdanovich says, well, why don't I play the part? And Welles says, well, you can't play the part. You're already playing, you know, the biographer. And he says, no. You know, he says, I can do it. That, you know, you didn't shoot that much of that. Just reshoot that with somebody else, and I'll come do this. So Welles says, you know, oh, my God, you're saving my life. So Bogdanovich in 70 is playing himself and playing out his relationship with Welles. And in 74, his status has changed. His relationship with Welles has changed, and he is now playing out his exact relationship with Welles in 74 by changing characters. So that, you know, to me is always kind of the – it kind of explains the shorthand version of what the movie was like. You know, there was this weird, you know, nobody talking about it, but incredibly autobiographical element where life was imitating, or art was imitating life. At a certain point, the life began to imitate, you know, the art.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem, I think, that Welles had with a lot of these productions, and Other Side of the Wind is sort of the ultimate example of that, is that he had so many investors from all these different sources that it's like everyone felt like they owned a little piece of it here and there. And you could never quite get a consensus of who owns what. Cause I mean, as I was reading your book and I'm picturing like all this footage just piling up in places and film cans being stored. And I mean, that's another thing that I think people nowadays maybe don't have an appreciation of, is that, you know, you shoot a movie now, you're shooting digitally. So it's not it's not physically existing anywhere. But back then, Wells had to literally store this footage in places, and there was a physical object that people that had given Wells money could say, well, that part's mine. I own that part. And that became a real complication.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that got so crazy. You know, he was at one point – so he raised – you know, the financing of the film, which, you know, ordinarily the financing of a film is not super exciting to me. But the financing of this film was just so – completely bizarre. He started out with what was ostensibly his own money, which right away, you know, kind of gives you a sense of his business judgment. You
right,
know,
they always like say never do that. Rule, yeah. Don't ever do that.
Right. The golden rule of Hollywood is other people's money, right?
Right.
And everyone you meet who's rich in Hollywood, you know, from investing in movies, you know, it's that, you know, they've done it with other people's money. So, so Wells puts his own money into it. Then he has to go out and raise some money. And first he finds a couple of he's in Europe, and he finds these two German brothers who do films in Europe, and that they invest some money. And then he's shooting he wound up playing Long John Silver in a film version of Treasure Island in Spain. And the guy who was producing that film, and he started talking, and the guy is very charming, and Wells, you know, thought he was terrific. And the guy said, hey, I'll invest some money in your next movie. So now Wells has two investors. And he goes to Paris to do some editing on the other side of the wind, because he had a house in this area called Orvilliers. And while he's there, he's complaining about how he can't get money to, enough money to finish the film. And his assistant editor says, you know, oh, my God, come on, you're Orson Welles. A million people would give you money. And Welles says, well, introduce me to at least one. And this guy's ex-girlfriend, turns out she works for a company called, I'm going to mangle it, you know, the French pronunciation, but it's like Les Films de l'Astrophore. And it's a French production company owned by the Shah of Iran's brother-in-law and the nation of Iran. So literally, and what's really remarkable is, of all the people, the most reliable investor turned out to be the Shah of Iran's brother-in-law. That's like how crazy the story was. So this guy gave him a bunch of money, and so Wells went back and then continued shooting. Well, as time went on, you know, Wells just, he was, you know, he claimed one of the producers stole some of the money. You know, I don't know if the guy stole it or if the money just kind of disappeared, or if, you know, Wells is somebody who kind of like watched every penny but didn't watch every $20,000.
Right, right.
You know, he'd be like, you know, reuse that gaffer's tape, you know, but he would, you know, smoke, you know, $600 worth of cigars and that kind of
right.
thing. Like literally. So what happened was, you know, he started having, he had falling outs with all the different producers. And he kind of wound up holding the film hostage at various points. And yes, all these different people kind of felt that they owned a share of the film. And Wells had really used up his own equity in the film. And, you know, so he kind of owned nothing, none of it. And they, so the Iranians kept having to restore Wells' share of the film for him to keep working on it. And it was just totally crazy. And at one point, he, in the middle of the night, he thought the editors were working at the producer's direction, if I recall correctly, and were kind of undermining him. So he and Gary Graver, who was his cinematographer, went into the lab in Paris in the middle of the night and just took the whole damn film. And like the editors came in the next morning and it was just gone. So, yeah, there were all kinds of shenanigans with it, and he wound up in a lawsuit in France, and since they couldn't settle things, the film was locked up in a vault in Paris until very recently.
Now, you mentioned the cinematographer, and that's Gary Graver. Gary Graver figures pretty large in your story, in your book, because this is a guy who, you know, basically got a job with Orson Welles just by calling him. he just called him one day and was like, hey, man, I'd love to work for you. And, like, you know, a couple days later, he gets a phone call back from Orson Welles, which is kind of
remarkable. Not even. It was that afternoon.
That afternoon.
Yeah, that to me, I mean, when I was saying, you know, I was really glad nobody had written a book, you know, I would read bits and I just started coming upon bits and pieces of this story. And the Gary Graver story was one of the things where I was like, yeah, nobody had told the whole story. But so I was like, wow, these are some really good stories. And the Graver story is incredible. Graver was a guy who, he worked basically on Roger Corman and Al Adamson, like low budget biker movie type movies. And he had done everything on a film set. And he just really, he loved working in movies. And he really wanted to work in good movies. But he knew how to do everything, and he knew how to do it on a low budget, you know, and he knew how to get things done, and he knew how to get people and stuff like that. So what happened was, he's sitting, I mean, this is like, you couldn't make this up. He's sitting in Schwab's, right? The famous, you know, drugstore, right? He opens a Variety, and he reads Army Archer's column. You know, the famous, you know, kind of guy who wrote the one of the dot, 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 you know, columns. And he reads, you know, and it says, you know, Patty Duke is back from her honeymoon. You know, Lawrence Harvey broke his knee. Oh, and Orson Welles is seen having dinner in Los Angeles. And Gary has always worshipped Welles. So he runs to the payphone and he starts, you know, he thinks to himself, where would Welles be if he was here? I bet he's at the Beverly Hills Hotel. So he calls Beverly Hills Hotel and asks for Orson Welles. Now, what's the chance that Orson Welles is staying somewhere under his own name, right? He says, Orson Welles, please. And they say, all of a sudden, the line starts to ring. And he's like, oh, my God. And, you know, he goes, hello, this is Orson Welles. I can't do Orson, you know, but, you know, just this incredible, you know,
that voice.
And he says, you know, right. I mean, which would just scare the crap out of, you know, anybody, you know, who, you know, even if you didn't know who he was, you know, just, so, you know, so, but so intimidating when you know who he is and you, you know, are a big movie person. And Gary just like spits out, you know, my name is Gary Graver. I'm a cameraman. I heard you're making a new movie because it said in Variety that he was, you know, working on a new film or about to start one. He said, I'd love to work for you, you know, in any capacity. And Orson was, you know, could be very gruff. And he was like, give me your phone number. I don't need anybody like you. And I'm actually on the air, heading to the airport in a few minutes. I'm flying out this afternoon. So, but, you know, if I ever need somebody like you, I'll give you a call. So he takes the number, you know, and Gary goes back to the table all dejected. And he and his wife drive home. And, they get in the driveway of their house, and they live in this, like, little house in Laurel Canyon. And Gary hears the phone ringing. And he just, you know, I'm sure some instinct, he's like, oh, my God. And he runs inside, and he picks up the phone, and he says, Gary, this is Orson. He says, I need you at the Beverly Hills Hotel right away. And so Gary, you know, just, like, boom, runs right back out, gets in his car, flies down to the Beverly Hills Hotel. So he goes in there, and, you know, all of a sudden, he's at a bungalow, and he's face-to-face with Orson. And Orson invites him in, and they talk, you know, for a few minutes. And this is, I mean, this is so crazy. So what happens is they're talking, and Orson says, you know, Gary, says, I'm about to make a new film called The Other Side of the Wind. That only one cameraman has ever come to me and said they wanted to work for me before. And that was Greg Toland, who shot Citizen Kane. He said, and you know, that worked out pretty well. He said, yeah. I figure this must just be good luck. He said, so I would like you to, you know, work with me as my cameraman and cinematographer on this new movie. And so Gary is sitting there like, you know, an hour ago, he's totally despondent over the fact that he blew his chance with Welles. And now, all of a sudden, Orson Welles is offering him this job. So Gary's kind of like, oh my God, you know, like, and he's, you know, thrilled. And the next thing he knows, Orson grabs him by the shoulders and throws him to the floor. And then Orson falls down on the floor next to him and basically throws one of his arms, which probably, you know, weighed, you know, 120 pounds, over Gary's back. And Gary is, you know, sitting there thinking, oh my God, what have I done? You know, who is this guy? You know, I barely know him. He's, you know, he's thrown me on the ground. He's holding me down. Gary's trying to get up and he's like struggling and Wells is pushing him down and he has no idea what's going on. And he's thinking, you know, maybe this was not the best idea I've ever had. And then slowly, you know, Wells kind of puts his finger to his lips and crawls over to the window and he crawls up and looks over the windowsill and then he stands up and he helps Gary up. And before Gary can even ask, Orson goes, I saw Ruth Gordon, you know, who's you know, from Harold and Maude,
right.
You know, the crazy old lady who, you know, had a grandmother just like her. So I totally get why he was feeling this way. But he said, I saw Ruth Gordon walking outside. And if she had seen me, she would have come in here and she would have talked all afternoon. She never would have shut up. He said, but I don't want to talk to Ruth Gordon. I want to talk to you.
Wow.
And literally from that moment on, the rest of Gary's life belonged to Orson Welles, even after Orson died.
Well, see, that's something that you touch upon a lot in the book, and I find fascinating, is the idea of how much Gary Graver and others were willing to subsume their personality and in many ways their entire life to Orson's will. That to me is fascinating because, I mean, Gary Graver had chances to work on other films, and he gave it up. He passed on a lot of opportunities to sort of be part of Orson's traveling band. And, you know, you talk a little bit about where he's having conversation with his wife about, well, how they're going to make money. And, you know, Orson's paying him on a Friday and literally with, like, you know, an envelope full of cash and stuff like that. And I find that stuff really fascinating. And just to relate it to something else that I've been doing, I have a whole other show on our network about Bob Dylan. And there's a bassist that Bob Dylan's been playing with now for 30 years. And I want to know that guy's story, because that guy, his name's Tony Garnier, he has decided to just devote the rest of his life to touring with Bob Dylan. And I'm fascinated with the idea of, like, Orson Welles as being someone so powerful and so magnetic that you are willing to put up with a lot of craziness just to be in his orbit. And because you don't make it, your book does not make it sound like shooting this movie was a lot of fun. It sounds very romantic. Oh, we were flying to here and there and doing all these crazy things and we're faking permits and we're going to hotels. But at the same time, it sounds like it really could have been a grind. And I have to wonder at what point, after you've spent so many months with Orson Welles, do you start to say, all right, you know, like, I think I've had my fill of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a million great stories about how, you know, first of all, he was incredibly magnetic, you know, and there was some great quote, and I think this would apply to John Huston too, honestly. I think Geraldine Fitzgerald, the actress, said, you know, Orson was like the beam of a lighthouse. She said, when you were caught in the beam, you were completely dazzled, and when the beam moved away, you were plunged into darkness. And that was really, you know, I mean, I think guys like Orson and John Huston, you know, everybody who met them, that was something that person, if it was 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 years, they would never forget their time that they met him. You know, it was like, you know, like one of the big memories of their life. If you met Orson Welles. And he had all this charisma and he had all this personality. But when Orson walked away, you know, he probably wouldn't remember you 5 weeks later unless he needed something.
Right, right.
So there was this, you know, incredible charisma. Also, this is at the time where kind of people are starting to go to film school and people are kind of developing into, like, film nerds, essentially. And Welles is, like, the tragic hero for these people, right? I mean, he is, you know, the guy who ever, you know, if it weren't for all the, you know, business people, he would have made, you know, 1,000 masterpieces. So, you know, you have young people who are, you know, mostly Gary's buddies who are working on Corman films who, like, worship this guy. And they're like, holy crap, I get to work with Orson Welles. And they're young and they're energetic and they'll do anything to learn. And he's a genius. And you learn all this incredible stuff from him. And, you know, he just, I think it was John Moreau there was a great quote from her where she said something about like how if he calls, if Orson calls you, it must be important, and therefore you run right to where he is. And I think that was the whole thing, was people were like, Orson Welles is making a movie, and it is important that Orson Welles is making a movie, and therefore I will do this with him. And I will do what it takes, you know, even if I don't get paid for a month, you know, even if, you know, I get paid by him getting me on a Chevy commercial, you know, as a cameraman or something 6 weeks later. But, you know, Gary was the most extreme example of that. But my favorite was there's a guy named Glenn Jacobson who was kind of a Guy Friday type of character for Orson. And he lived in like Santa Monica or something, and he got a call on a Sunday morning, and it was Orson. And Orson goes, Glenn, he says, I need somebody to go to the pharmacy for me, but I don't have my prescriptions, and you know, I've run out, and I'm gonna, you know, and Orson sounds like he's gonna die. You must get over here immediately. And so, you know, he's all the way, you know, in Santa Monica or wherever, and so he gets in his car and he goes flying across Los Angeles, and he gets up to Beverly Hills. There's Orson, you know, sitting there looking perfectly well, smoking a cigar, drinking his coffee, and he says, you know, I'm here to get the prescriptions. And Orson goes, yes, and here actually is a list of pastries that I'd like you to pick up at the bakery next to the pharmacy. You know? And he did that. I mean, he did that kind of stuff all the time. People just, yeah, I don't know that there are people like that anymore. I know there are people who act like that, but I'm not sure. You know, one of the things that attracted me to the book, too, honestly, was it felt like kind of a, you know, really rare chance to write about the Hollywood figures who were larger than life in that way. Because he and Houston were both just embodied that kind of larger than life nature.
It's interesting that I mean, him and Houston were great friends, and he had been in some of Houston's movies. He's in the Kremlin Letter, which is a John Houston movie. But, I mean, John Houston seems just as sort of irascible and kind of difficult as well. But yet Houston seemed to be able to work with the studios a lot better, because Houston's track record of cranking out classics is a lot greater than Welles's. I mean, as you said, like virtually every movie that Orson worked on post Citizen Kane has an asterisk next to it. You know, it has some, well, there's the missing ending, or there's the chop scene, or Othello, where he had to shoot it in hotel rooms and they didn't have any costumes, so we used bathrobes. You know, I mean, there's always some right. Sort of thing here and there, and it's kind of amazing. I wonder what kind of conversations they had, because Houston was able to continue to make films all the way into the mid-80s, up until when he died, and he continued to make great movies.
Well, Houston, you know, in a lot of ways, my favorite story ever about him, and I always think this kind of embodies him, is when he was, I think, the first director to kind of set up an independent production company. I may be wrong about that, but when the first independent production companies really started, where, you know, directors started having their own production companies, he was, you know, he was like a golden boy in Hollywood, and he could have paired up with anybody. And he wound up, you know, starting a company with Sam Spiegel, who was a guy who was not, you know, didn't have a great track record, was, you know, kind of considered, you know, uncouth and disreputable and stuff like that. And somebody asked Houston why he did it at the time. And he said, because it was the wrong thing to do. And that, you know, kind of like, you know, in fact, I think he said, he was sitting in his car and he said, it was the wrong thing to do, kid. And then he backed out and, you know, pulled away, you know, in some great dramatic fashion. You know, Houston had the right attitude. I think, you know, Welles, you know, was so, I think, emotionally involved in his films. In a way that I think Houston was emotionally involved, but the difference was, you know, Welles, everything, you know, kind of had to be, I think, a masterpiece. And it had to be his vision. And so he would, you know, he wouldn't make a movie and be like, well, that's good enough, I'm moving on to the next one. And he wouldn't take a project as a director. He did acting jobs to you know, work and make money. But he wouldn't just direct a picture. It had to be, you know, a picture that he was so compelled to make and about which he felt, you know, incredibly deeply and really connected to. Houston was a guy, you know, first of all, he didn't give a crap. That was kind of his attitude. So, you know, if the studio was mad at him, they really had nothing on him because he was just like, I don't give a crap. You know, he exuded that. He exuded, you know, a devil may care, like, you don't own me thing. And that made him an equal with these people. He also was perfectly willing to do things. You know, he was a great artist, but as a filmmaker and otherwise, but he was someone who was perfectly willing to say, okay, I'll take on a crappy movie and make it into a mediocre movie for somebody. And I'll take a mediocre movie and make it into a good movie for somebody. As you know, I'll make those two movies, but that earns me the opportunity to make the movie I want for the third movie. So he knew how to work the system. And honestly, I think, you know, like, Orson gave too much of a crap, and Houston was the absolute opposite. You just had this sense, I think, that he could walk away from anything and just go on. You know, they're both guys. They had so many similarities, and, you know, and they both lived these incredibly chaotic lives financially, you know, and just in terms of, you know, their personal lives. But I think Houston really rolled with stuff. And I think Wells kind of, he survived stuff and he ignored stuff. But he didn't roll with it so much.
Right. He took it to heart. I mean, I'm old enough to remember I was a teenager when Orson Welles died in 1985. So I'm old enough to remember his kind of reputation near the end of his life. And unfortunately, I think in the eyes of a lot of younger people, not that at 15, I was having lots of conversations about Orson Welles, but like there was the kind of perception that he was a joke because he was so willing to put his name onto crappy stuff. And, you know, if you don't know the context of why he's doing it, you're like, oh, well, come on, this guy, you know, he's a voice in History of the World, you know, Mel Brooks' History of the World, or he's doing the Paul Masson wine commercials, or he's a voice in Transformers the movie, and, you know, or he's doing the Frozen Peas ads. And once you start digging into the backstory and you realize, well, he was simply willing to cash in on his name and the reflected glory that these other projects would get by having him involved. So we could take that money and put it into his own projects. You're like, well, it's basically Kickstarter. It's just Kickstarter before there was Kickstarter. And nobody looks down on Kickstarter now. Everybody says, oh, you went and self-funded your own movie? Good for you, man. But that wasn't available to Orson. So Orson did a voiceover for a crappy movie. But unfortunately, I think it made Orson look bad. Because people didn't know. They just thought, oh, he's just, you know, doing it to enrich himself. And it's like, no, it's because he's trying to finish these movies that he wants to make.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's funny. I mean, today, you know, it's what always has been fascinating about this is that, you know, today somebody like Orson would not have been able to – somebody would not have allowed him to have the problems he had, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, I mean, I don't know that a character like him would exist today, but somebody who was a producer would have just put their arm around him and said, you know what, I don't care how much you're going to hate me. I don't care how much you're going to try to get rid of me. Like, we're going to make this all happen for you.
Right, right.
And, you know, all of his weaknesses, you know, would be, you know, I think, covered up. And Hollywood, you know, would recognize that this guy was a great filmmaker. You know, and he'd whatever career he had, he would have a real career, and it wouldn't be marked by all these, you know, like what might have been. But at the time, that wasn't going on. You know, and by this time, he felt, you know, I'm not sure rightfully that he'd been burned so many times by Hollywood, and that they were the bad guys, that he felt so contemptuously towards people with money, that you know, he was not going to get a lot of money from the studio. If they were going to give him money, he was contemptuous of them and didn't trust them. So making these commercials funded the way he lived. He didn't make his living as a director. He made his living, you know, as a pitch man and as an actor in anybody's movies, you know, he said he would just, you know, he remained virginal for his directing career, but he was, you know, willing to prostitute himself for to make a living. So he, Yeah, and you know, it's really. I think a little bit older than you, but I mean, I was, you know, probably like 19 when he died. And yeah, I mean, he was, you know, Orson Welles was, you know, he was the, you know, big fat guy, you know, who told the, you know, stories on Johnny Carson and smoked the big cigars and did the Palmasan wine commercials and all that. Yeah, he was not, you know, what I think he's, you know, he was before or what he's grown into.
Yeah, I mean, if he had somehow been alive today, you would have like a Quentin Tarantino, you know, someone with some real juice would be sort of, you know, presenting an Orson Welles film. You know, you would have, you know, Guillermo del Toro presents Orson Welles's This, because people would recognize that this guy. I mean, it's something reminds me of, I think it's, I forget which film it is. I think it's Ron. Akira Kurosawa's Ron, where he couldn't get the financing to make that movie. And George Lucas and Steven Spielberg basically just gave him the money. They were such fans. And they were like, this is crazy. This master of cinema can't get a movie made. So they just funded it. And, you know, that's how that movie got done. And to that end, there's an extraordinary piece of video back when I was working at a video store right after art school, and I was doing the deep dive into I was just watching every Welles thing I could get my hands on, no matter how bad it was. I was like, Ricky Tikki Tavi does the voiceover, I'll watch that. Scene of the Crime,
right?
Some horrible TV show, David Hasselhoff, I'll watch it because it's Orson Welles. But there's of course the AFI tribute that they gave him.
Yeah,
and he comes up on stage. He plays a scene from Other Side of the Wind, and speaking to all of these well-heeled people in the room, including George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and all of these big he basically asks the room for money to finish the movie. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, you know, that whole thing, that was like, to me, in a lot of ways, that's where everything, I mean, it was crazy before that, but that was when it really became like, you know, his life was now imitating the movie. The scene he showed, right, was a scene from the film in which his producer is showing clips of this crazy movie that Jake Hannaford is making to a studio guy trying to raise money. And the clips, you know, don't necessarily make sense. And the guy says, you know, is there a script? And he says, you know, well, you know, Jake, you know, he said he's carrying the whole film in his head. And he said, and the studio guy says he's just making it up as he goes along, isn't he? Which is, you know, I think what the suspicion was of what Welles was doing, because the script changed all the time. Nobody ever saw the script. And there are all these rumors about the movie. So he is showing this scene that is confirming everything people are suspicious about and using it to pitch funding to complete the movie. And it's it's so surreal. And it's an incredible performance. I mean, he has everybody, you know, really kind of, it's touching, it's heartfelt, it's this and that, and then it just kind of turns into this weird pitch. You know, and a little bit of like this kind of, you know, snarky comment, because the guy from the studio resembles Robert Evans, and he kind of makes a reference to that. And just, yeah, I mean, I remember another project another book I wrote, they were talking about a famous comedy writer who left National Lampoon magazine right before, this huge buyout, in which he would have gotten incredibly rich. And somebody said he had the worst business moves of anybody I know, you know, just the worst timing always. And Orson, kind of his instincts were just abysmal. You know, if he had just given this lovely speech afterwards, people probably would have said, you know, Orson, come see me on Monday, you know, and let me watch your film. But he turned it into this, you know, this just kind of weird, you know, life crossing into the movie crossing into the life, you know, okay, I'm going to spit in your face, give me some money.
Yeah, it's truly surreal. I mean, I've seen a lot of those other AFI tributes from the time, And, you know, it's like Jimmy Cagney and Alfred Hitchcock and James Stewart. And, you know, everybody goes up and they give these warm speeches and they thank everyone for their great career. Because most of these people, of course, were in the twilight of their career at this point. And here comes Orson Welles, you know, rambling on stage saying, hey, guys, give me some money. And here's some footage. Here's a clip reel.
Right.
It really is truly bizarre. And as you talk about the movie, we haven't really talked about the style of this movie. It's sort of an assault on the senses because it's black and white, it's color, it's surrealist, it's sort of faux documentary. It's got a little bit of everything. It's really not the kind of movie you would expect a man who was in, 1970, he would have been 55.
55, yeah.
Yeah, it's not the kind of movie you expect a 55-year-old man to make. It's very vital and fresh, and it feels very of its time. It doesn't look dated. For a guy who was, you know, kind of older at that point. So the movie itself is – I've only seen two scenes. I've seen the two scenes, the one you mentioned, and then there's another one that's on YouTube. And those are the only bits of it I've seen. Have you seen more of the movie at this point?
Yeah, I've seen – there's like about 40 minutes of edited footage Then there's a reel with a lot of the, you know, kind of unedited stuff or partially edited stuff. And, it's interesting. Parts of it are really incredible. The thing that really got me was, were the performances, particularly, Bogdanovich and Houston, because they're both, you know, guys who, you know, bring who they are, right, to this part, to anything. I mean, you know, if John Huston's playing a role, that role is always kind of John Huston doing something. Now he's playing John Huston, right?
Right.
In this, because he's playing this, you know, director like John Huston. And Bogdanovich is, you know, he's Bogdanovich. He's, you know, the Hollywood guy, you know, he can do all the celebrity imitations. He, you know, is kind of show busy in a very specific way. And he's playing, you know, himself, essentially. And somehow, Welles, he got them each, and I know he didn't ask them to just, like, there's always something behind that kind of persona. You know, there's always another person there, too. And those are two guys who you never see that other side of them. And you just get this little glimpse of each of them, not as themselves, at just the right time, where it's just incredible. It's hard to explain, but there's like about 30 seconds of vulnerability from John Huston, who's like invulnerable, unkillable human being who ever lived, that are just extraordinary. You know, I mean, so that was incredible. I mean, I found it very moving. Bogdanovich, who, you know, is a super nice guy in real life, but is like, you know, not all his persona is not always, you know, likable, and his persona is not always sympathetic, and you feel such sympathy for him, in you know, a few moments of the film. And so, you know, what it's all going to be when they finally edit it together, I don't know. I hope it'll be terrific. You know, and I have faith in the people who are doing it that it'll be, you know, terrific.
Well, as someone who, until I read your book, only was sort of, you know, tangentially following it because, you know, I mean, this is almost like in a lot of ways pre-internet where you would hear about it and you would say, oh, you would hear a couple people say, we're finishing Other Side of the Wind, guaranteed this time. And then I'd hear about it.
Right.
No, that fell apart. All right. And then, no. Peter Bogdanovich, he's going to do it. He's going to finish it. He has the negative. It's going to – no, that fell apart. And your book goes through all that, and it's so frustrating because you're just like, everybody, just get together and pull this – you know, come on. And when your book ends, you know, the movie is still kind of in limbo. But now, thanks to the bottomless pockets – of Netflix, Netflix is going
right
to finish Other Side of the Wind. And they have, there's some short documentary stuff they have on their YouTube channel talking about it. So where does it stand now? Do you know, like, how close are we to actually seeing this finished movie?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I know that the negative left Paris, you know, finally, you know, got dusted off after all those years. So it's in L.A. I know that they've been, you know, combing through, you know, all the footage. And, you know, I think, you know, they're, as far as I know, you know, I would guess, you know, like in the next 18 months, maybe 2 years, the film will finally be seen. You know, Joe McBride, you know, I got to know him fairly well in working on this, and he always used to say, you know, that he figured he'd be going to the premiere on his walker, you know. And other people, you know, would, you know, there was a lot of, you know, I hope I live long enough, you know, and you know, one of the other great things about the movie, I mean, not great for them, but, you know, several cast members died during the making, not because of the making of the movie, but people just died because, yeah, you know, as the film was going on forever. You know, so that was always, you know, kind of, there was a little irony to the fact that people were dying off as the film was going on.
When eventually does see the light of day, and I hope that Netflix gives it a theater screening. You know, I know that they're big, uh-huh, on just everything is going to be on their platform. But I would love to have the chance to see, you know, another Orson Welles movie on the big screen. Do you feel as though once people see it that it has maybe, for lack of a better word, value as anything other than a museum piece? I mean, do you think that the film by itself and what you've seen of it will work as a movie, an entertaining, interesting story, and there's, you know, there's the benefit of knowing all the backstory that, oh my God, this is Orson Welles' last movie and all this other stuff. But do you think that just someone who doesn't know the troubled history can just would maybe want to sit through this and find it a worthwhile thing to watch?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I'm not sure I have the answer. I mean, I think it's you know, if and I have every bit of faith, you know, I know some of the people involved in completing it, you know, and I have every bit of faith that they're going to do a terrific job, and that it's going to be, you know, really good. Like whether it will be an, you know, kind of an art house type of thing, because, you know, Welles ultimately is kind of an art house director.
Oh, yeah.
You know, though probably, you know, capable of making films that have mass appeal. Yeah, it's certainly capable of making films that have mass appeal. And whether it will have mass appeal, I'm not sure. You know, I think the story, one thing that will make it interesting to people, I think, is the time period. Because I think that could really draw an audience. It's such a, you know, capsule of Hollywood at a certain, you know, in the early 70s. And, you know, so it remains to be seen. I know, I will tell you one thing. One thing it has going for it is that it is going to be probably incredibly well publicized if it gets a theatrical release. You know, because Netflix has invested a lot in this. And, you know, and I think, you know, you've got incredible people working on it. So I would have every hope that it will draw, you know, a good, really good audience. Is it going to be, you know, like, you know, like the next Thor movie? No.
No.
You know, it's not going to be an Avengers film. It's not going to be, you know, a Transformers movie. But I think it has potential, you know, to be, you know, like successful in the way a Woody Allen movie is successful.
Right. Yeah, I would hope that I could maybe take someone to it if it ever does play in a theater and they don't know all the backstory. This is just the story. And when you think about all the money that filmmakers today spend to make their movies look like the gritty 70s, whether it's, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson with Inherent Vice or Shane Black with The Nice Guys, you know, we're kind of in that mode now where we want things to look like the 70s. Well, here, this movie is the 70s. I mean, this movie is exactly what Hollywood, as you said, looked like in 1970, 71, 72. There's no recreation. It is exactly what it looked like with the bell bottoms and the mutton chops and everything. This is what Hollywood looked like. So, like I said, I certainly hope that when it does arrive, I mean, I have yet to see any Welles movie. I've seen them all, except for maybe some of the shorts, but I've seen everything. and they're all interesting in one way or the other. They're all vital. Yeah. They're all alive. And from the little bits and pieces I've seen of Other Side of the Wind, that seems to be the case with this movie. So I've been patient. I joked on Twitter. This is how you and I got started. Was I said that this movie started being shot the year I was born. And so I'm always assuming that it will be the release the year I die. That seems to be, you know. But I hope it comes out before that, because I really do want to be able to say that I got to see another Orson Welles movie in the theater. That would be great.
Right, right, absolutely. No, I think it's going to be a very good movie. I think they're going to do a really nice job with it, and I think it's going to be a movie worth people seeing for sure. And I think it will be, like you were saying. You know, it will be a vital movie. It will be a Welles movie. It's just gonna be different than some of the other stuff he's done, which is great.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah, I found out that the Netflix is raising the price of its monthly rental things for $9.99 to $10.99. And my attitude is, you know what? If my extra buck a month is helping pay for the restoration of Other Side of the Wind, I totally do that. That's worth it.
Right.
I find that a worthwhile use of my money. So that's great. So
that's a very healthy way of looking at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only time I've ever had let me take it back. I've seen Touch of Evil on the big screen, but there was an art house here in Southern New Jersey that when it opened for the first weekend, they ran nothing but old movies, and they ran Citizen Kane. And I watched Citizen Kane 3 times in 2 days. I was like, here's my chance.
Cool.
I'm not getting a chance to see Citizen Kane on the big screen. And so, yeah, his movies are just – they're something special. So the fact that it's out there gives me hope. So, Josh, thank you so, so much, A, for writing the book. I thought it was just great.
Thank you.
I loved it. I loved every – it's one of those books that when it was over, I was like, I wish there was more to this. You know, I wish I could keep reading.
Oh, thank you. Fascinating. Thank you. That's so nice.
Yeah. And thank you so much for coming on. This has just been terrific.
Oh, my pleasure.
I don't get to talk about Orson Welles very much on the show just because I don't know that many people that are familiar with his movies outside of Citizen Kane. So I'm just thrilled to be able to talk to you about it. So before we sign off, is there another project you want to talk about? Like something you're working on?
I'm working on some a TV pilot and just doing some magazine articles right now.
Okay.
And I'm kind of fishing around for another book subject. So nothing else exciting going on.
All right, cool. Well, that's it. Everybody, go check out Orson Welles' last movie. It's available on Amazon. You can get it in book form. You can get it in audiobook form. Even if you're not a particular hugely Welles fan, as Josh was not, as he talked about early in the show, it's a fascinating read of just the idea, the magnetism someone can have, and how that, you know, you can sort of orbit that person, and the willingness that people had to subsume their lives for this project. It's just a really, really fascinating read. And if you're a Welles fan, it's indispensable reading. So go check it out. So Josh, again, thank you so much for coming on.
I really
appreciated it.
Anytime. Thank you, Rob.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. As always, you can find back episodes of our show on our network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking about movies over on Twitter, which is @FilmAndWaterPod. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Mr. Hannaford's night. Let's save the questions for him, huh?
You two are very close, aren't you?
Yes, I'd like to ask you about that.
Why?
Come on, Hunter. Why do you think you have to be as rude
as
he is?
As rude as you are, in print anyway.
I liked your last picture. No, I know that it was repetitive, but for what it was, it worked.
Yeah, well, she wasn't that kind to me in her review. Not that you did me too much harm. I mean, how much harm can you do to the third biggest grocer in movie history?
Really make that much? How marvelous.
Yes, did you know that when his own production company goes public, that your friend there stands to walk away with $40 million?
Yeah, and she's going to say that I'm just going to keep on writing that I stole everything from you, Skipper. I'm never going to walk away from that.
Well, it's all right to borrow from each other. What we must never do is borrow from ourselves. Come on.
Of course you're close, you two. You have to be. You have no choice.
Please, dear lady, don't tell us what you mean by that.